Yeah, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Educating the World's Poorest Children. This event is sponsored by the World Affairs Council Young Professionals International Forum and co-sponsored by TAI. My name is Iris Engeling, and I am one of the program coordinators for tonight's event. I would also like to thank my colleagues of the Young Professionals International Forum, Jennifer Bernstedt and Catherine Jansen, who were instrumental in putting this event together. For those who may be new to the organization, the World Affairs Council was established in 1947 to engage the public in the exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. To learn more about this organization and its diverse series of programs, please visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. The Young Professionals International Forum, known as the IF, is a volunteer subcommittee of the World Affairs Council, founded to promote the involvement of younger council members. The IF creates public programs as well as organizes social and cultural events that provide an environment for younger people with international interests to meet and share experiences. Before we begin, please take a moment to silence all cell phones. While you do that, let me take this opportunity to announce a few upcoming IF events. Next week on Tuesday, November 10th, join the IF for our second development program this month, this time on healthcare in Africa. Panelists from four prestigious nonprofit organizations that are working on the ground in Africa will join us for a conversation on what's working and what isn't from the standpoint of medicine, leadership, and sustainability. This event will take place here in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. And then the following day, on Wednesday, November 11th, the IF is proud to again collaborate with Room to Read for their Beer for Books Happy Hour. Proceeds from the Happy Hour will go directly to the Room to Dream campaign, with the goal of reaching 5 million children worldwide. The Happy Hour fundraiser will be held from 6 to 10 p.m. at Minx, located up the road at 827 Sutter Street. And finally, on Wednesday, November 18th, the IF invites you to join us for a timely discussion on maritime piracy. Our panel will include representatives from the U.S. Navy, the academic community, and the maritime shipping industry, and will examine why piracy has returned with such a vengeance, the reasons for its growth, and how best to combat it. This discussion will take place here in the Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Lastly, I would like to encourage you all to make use of the blue question cards that have been placed on your seats. Please write legibly and hand your question cards to Council staff members. Audience questions will be posed to our speaker during the second half of our program. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator for this evening. Sarah Abbasi is a trustee of the World Affairs Council and chair of the Board of Directors of Development and Literacy, a U.S.-based nonprofit organization established to promote female literacy in the remote, underdeveloped areas of Pakistan. In 2001, Ms. Abbasi launched the San Francisco chapter of Developments in Literacy, and in 2003, Ms. Abbasi and her husband endowed the Abbasi Program in Islamic Studies at Stanford University. The Abbasi Program aims to promote better understanding of Islam, Muslims, and Islamic civilization. Here to moderate tonight's discussion, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Sarah Abbasi.
Thank you, Iris, for that kind introduction. I would now like to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. John Wood is founder and executive chairman of Room to Read, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting and enabling global education. At the age of 35, John Wood left an executive career track at Microsoft to form Room to Read. And since its creation less than 10 years ago, Room to Read has sponsored the opening of more than 750 schools and 7,000 libraries across the developing world. In his award-winning memoir, Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, he tells a story of how he raised over $80 million of financial commitments from a standing start to develop one of the fastest-growing nonprofits in history. He joins us this evening to share how he was able to develop Room to Read into such a successful organization, and how his unique business and nonprofit approach guide his vision of educating some of the world's poorest children. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming John Wood.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Iris. Hello, young professionals. I kind of feel like a middle-aged professional speaking to a group of young professionals. This title will eventually make sense. Bear with me. Can you guys see the slides from that angle over there? You're all right? You picked the wrong seat.
Should I move?
No. It's not you. It's them. I don't know. I'm a bit worried about you guys. How bad is the sight line?
Pretty bad.
Do you guys want to pick your chairs up and move them over there in the next minute so you get a good... I mean, seriously. Take action. Get it done. No excuses. It's the only way the world changes. We don't sit around talking about this solution. We got to... Come on. Snap to it. Give these guys a hand. Maybe they'll be a little quicker. Come on. You know, because if we didn't do that, you guys are going to be over there, like, checking your BlackBerries and texting to people, and then I'd be really a little bit taken aback. Okay, cool. We're set? Okay, good. Let's go. So, me, my book, Leaving Microsoft to Change the World. The one thing I want to say about my book, besides the fact that it's on sale here, is that I got this title before Bill Gates could get this title, and that is a very nice thing in life, to be ahead of Bill. I'm hoping that one day Bill will ask to license my intellectual property, at which point we can discuss the financial terms and conditions. My first school I ever visited in Nepal was this absolutely dilapidated, overcrowded school with terrible conditions. How many of you have ever been in the developing world and seen a situation like this, which just kind of saddens you? It's heartening that people are gathering and trying to learn. It's very sad the conditions that are there. I went to Nepal in 1998 simply as a break from Microsoft. I joined the company in 91. The growth was explosive. My career trajectory was probably bigger and steeper than I deserved for it to be. But I wanted to head off in 98 for a long break. I thought an 18-day trek in the Annapurna Range would be a fantastic escape. I wanted to escape from my cell phone, escape from email, escape from the 724, always being on call. Mostly, I wanted to escape from this guy. There was a rumor that if you went high enough in Himalayas, you could escape the sound of Steve Ballmer screaming at you to work harder. And so I decided to kind of take that and try it. And so I met this headmaster during my trek, and he invited me to come see his school. And it was just absolutely depressing to see the conditions that these kids were being asked to learn in. And the headmaster then said, let's go see the library. So I thought, okay, this will be the happy part of the tour, right? The library. It'll be a place where kids have smiles on their faces as they read books, the colorful children's books. And, you know, not for the first time in human history, there was a naive American traipsing around the developing world making stupid assumptions, because this library looked like this, an empty room where theoretically a library could have existed, but they had no desks, no chairs, and most importantly, they had no books. And I asked the headmaster, what's the deal? And he said, well, we have some books. And he pointed to a cabinet in the back with a padlock on it, because the books were precious. They must be kept locked away. Note that, fans of irony, that the books are not accessible to the children. And when he brought the books out, they were literally just backpacker cast-offs. They were things that trekkers had left behind, but they were completely inappropriate for children. I'm the literary snob. I think every child should read Danielle Steele romance novels at some point of their pedagogical development. And what kid doesn't enjoy the Jackie Collins Bodice Ripper every now and then? But, you know, they just didn't have any children's books. And the headmaster explained to me, he said, we are too poor to afford education, but until we have education, we'll always be poor. And I don't think I've ever heard a better encapsulation of what is wrong with international development. This is such an overlooked issue. Too poor to afford it, but until you have it, you'll probably always be poor. All of us can probably think of a parent, grandparent, or a great-grandparent who broke the cycle of poverty for our family because they were the first to go through high school or through university or whatever it might be, the first to gain literacy. The headmaster then spoke a sentence that would, for me, forever change my life. And chapter one of my book is titled, Perhaps, Sir, You Will Someday Come Back with Books. His very simple, very heartfelt request. And I thought about this request for days upon days as I trekked higher and higher and higher into the mountains. And on day 9 of my trek, I woke up in the middle of the night. I had this vision in the middle of the night. And I may have had a vision because I was drinking the local grain alcohol at 15,000 feet of elevation, but you must take your visions in life where you can get them. But this time, my vision was not, thankfully, of Steve Ballmer. It was of, you know, good old Andrew Carnegie, the patron saint of libraries. Carnegie gave America a fantastic gift. He established over 3,000 libraries across North America that have paid dividends for tens of millions of people for generation after generation after generation. When Carnegie grew up, if you were poor, you did not have access to books. There was a divide, and 90% of the people were poor. So the rich got smarter, and the poor stayed poor. Carnegie changed all that in one masterstroke with his network of libraries. I did not have Carnegie's resources, but my vision included a way that I could probably do Carnegie one better. My goal was to come back to Nepal, to that village of Bahundanda, and I wanted to be Carnegie with a yak. The idea being that I'm a marketing guy. You need like a brand. You need an iconic image. But I wanted to basically, that they had 450 kids at this school. So my theory was to have so many books that I would need to have like a flotilla of yaks or a gaggle, a fleet of yaks, a full frontal yak attack with thousands of books. I grew up as a kid always reading, always loving books. So I thought I could do this for these children in this village of Bahundanda. I went back a year later. My 73-year-old father, who was failing at retirement and driving my mom crazy, so my mom suggested that he go with me, which was a unique offer that my parents made to me, that my dad could come with me through the developing world. I don't know if any of you have traveled solo with an adult parent as an adult yourself through the developing world for more than a week, but if you haven't done it, you should, because if I had to do it, you also should have to do it. No, I'm kidding. We had a great time. My dad and I totally bonded. And I think what most got us to bond was the reaction we got from the kids. We actually went to 10 different schools. My co-founder of Room to Read, Dinesh Shrestha, told me, you know, don't give all the books to one school. Share the wealth between 10 schools. But the thing I was most excited about was going back to Bahundanda, and the kids were all lined up, and they'd picked the flowers, and they had marigold garlands string around their necks, and there were 450 little people doing the namaste as you go through the line of kids. And at the end, we thought we'd get the kids to all queue up and have each kid, you know, pick like 5 books and walk them into the library in this nice, neat line, and it would all be orderly. And as you can see, we just completely succeeded at that goal. These kids had never seen brightly colored children's books before, so they were like stage diving onto the books. It was like a mosh pit, or like it was like literacy palooza, as these, at least 3 of you under the age of 35 got that reference. And it was probably, for me, one of the greatest feelings of my life. One of the teachers came up to me, and he held my hand, and he said, "You have done so much for us, and we have so little we can do in return." And I didn't know how to explain to him that what he had just done for me and what his kids had done for me was bigger and better than anything else I could have spent my money on or my time on. It just left me with this absolutely fantastic feeling. And that night, my dad and I sat down and had a beer, and this is not a picture of us having a beer at night. This is the slide that gets you to focus on me. I realized that as soon as I clicked it. I'm like, my dad and I having a beer at night. And I was saying to him, you know, this felt so great, but it's just such a drop in the ocean compared to what's needed. Like, we need to go bigger at this. This is just not even beginning to address the problem. How does this scale? How do you get to Carnegie-like proportions and do, you know, not 10 libraries, but do hundreds or do thousands of libraries? And I went back to Beijing, where I was running business development for Microsoft China. I was number 2 in the greater China region. And after about 2 months of trepidation, I walked into my boss's office, and with absolute sheer panic, I quit my position and said, I'm going to devote the rest of my life to doing something different. And so I'm walking away from this at the height of my career, which most people don't do at age 35. Usually you retire and then you do philanthropy. And I decided to just skip the whole career part of it and just dive straight into philanthropy. And the reaction I got from my coworkers was, let's just say it wasn't overly supportive. There was kind of like this, OMG had not yet been invented as an acronym, but that was kind of the reaction I got of, you know, you're crazy, you're having a midlife crisis, what are you doing? And I kind of was expecting this, like, let's go have a beer, let's celebrate, you're going to do something different with your life. And we didn't really get much of that. And I think it's important to say that, you know, in life, you know, there's a saying that I think was Voltaire said, that nobody ever erected a statue in honor of a critic. And I always tell audiences, especially university students, you know, keep that in mind, because when people think your idea is crazy, maybe that's a good thing. That if that people think your idea is like really good and conventional, then maybe it's a little bit boring. But for me, it was difficult. People always ask me, what was it like? I mean, it was terrifying. I think one of the reasons is that, you know, it was a total loss of status to go from having a title and a position. I mean, when you go to a cocktail party in the United States, what's the first thing people ask you? What do you do? And I was going from my blah, blah, I have this fancy title, and then I was like, I deliver books on the back of yaks in rural Himalayan villages, at which point you are standing alone with the chip dip. that's great. You're not really competing then for chip dip, but you're kind of just sitting there on your own. And so the question came up of, you know, why, you've got the most productive decades of your life, you're making, you know, a gazillion dollars, why go do this? And I think for me, it's partly because of my own upbringing. This is Spalding Memorial Library in a small town of Athens, Pennsylvania. Athens, Pennsylvania was not an intellectual hotbed, but we did have a great library. We had a good public school, a school library. My father was the only one of seven kids in his family to go to college, and the only reason he went was because he got a scholarship. So I had all the advantages of life growing up, from Sesame Street to a mother who read to me. And so it felt a little bit like just karmic payback, that I've been given a lot, so I might as well do something with it. And for me, education was a great way to do something to pay the world back for my great good fortune that I'd had. I think bigger than that for me, though, is just that education is the one issue that has the ripple effect. It's the one issue that affects every other issue. You can look at education and graph it versus anything in the world that's good or bad, and usually see a pretty interesting relationship. This is UN data showing years the person can expect to go to school, depending on the country they live in, and then the GDP per person of that country. And you can see kind of in the bottom left, and Sarah, of course, is doing fantastic work in Pakistan. You can see where that is, so you got to kind of get kids educated, and then eventually over the course of a generation, you can hopefully move up to letting people have an escape out of poverty. Dambisa Moyo, in her book Dead Aid, Dambisa's on our board, by the way, points out that no country has ever successfully gotten out of poverty by relying on foreign aid. It doesn't work. It just is a steady drip, drip, drip that makes the country dependent. Education will do that for societies. You can look at education and family health. You can look at education and the situation for women. It all comes down to education and what can you do for people at a young age. You can look at life expectancy and how long people live. Again, it is basically proves that there is the ripple effect with education. You get that right, and then you get every other issue right. So for me, it seemed like kind of a no-brainer to do this with my life and to basically say, you know, there's a lot of need out there. There's a lot of kids who aren't being reached. And how do you tell a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old, you know, you don't get to go to school? That to me just seems like they lost the lottery of life. I won the lottery of life. And if you're a lottery winner, what do you want to do with your lottery winnings? You want to share them with others. And so I wanted to kind of go big with Room to Read because I believe in this wonderful, wonderful Yiddish saying. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but Tikkun Olam, anybody know how to pronounce that correctly? Thank you. Great. So to heal or repair the world. And I had traveled in a lot of places, probably as a lot of you have, where it seemed like there was a lot of repairing that was needed, certainly in Cambodia, where the Khmer Rouge murdered the teachers, burned down the schools, and burned the books. Yet 15 years after the Khmer Rouge had left villages, the schools still had not been rebuilt. You could look at Laos, one of the most heavily bombed countries on earth, courtesy of the United States, and you know the fact that kids grow up without education and the art the kids are doing is all about the trauma that their country has suffered. You can look at South Africa, the famous here Hector Peterson photo, where apartheid was used to really enforce the cruel divisions of apartheid. And when Nelson Mandela came to power as president, he said, the number one thing you can do to help South Africa is to educate our children. Help us educate our children. That's the way that things are going to move forward. So throughout the world, there was this pattern matching that was fairly easy to do. Yet when you looked at it and you looked at the numbers, they're pretty staggering. 300 million kids in the developing world woke up this morning and did not go to school. It happened yesterday, it happened today, it'll happen tomorrow. 300 million kids. That to me is a moral failure of our world. How can we accept the idea that 300 million kids will not go to school? At age 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, they basically at that point have lost the lottery of life because they're never going to get educated. There are 770 million people in the world today who are illiterate. One of 8 human beings cannot read or write. Nearly 2/3 of that group are girls and women. So you basically, if you don't get that right, you're not going to have a better world for anybody, because for both the boys and the girls, you want a mother who's educated and you want a mother who can read to you. So I sat in 2000, I moved to San Francisco, and I sat in my second bedroom, which I'd converted to the office. I called it the world headquarters of Room to Read, which was great because I was the only employee, so it was easy to convene a team meeting. And, you know, looked at these numbers and was pretty blown away by them. I thought about it and did the research and realized that when Carnegie started his program of library building back during the Little House on the Prairie era, the population of the entire United States was 63 million. Yet across the developing world, you had 770 million people who were illiterate. So it was literally 12x the number. Now, if you take that and play those numbers out, they're actually pretty scary, because 770 million people illiterate, 500 million approximately are women. If the average illiterate woman, and illiterate women have more children than educated women, the average illiterate woman has four kids. You have 2 billion kids with a mother who can't read to them. And that's not conjecture or theory, that's the reality. The population of the world is projected to grow from 6.5 billion to 9 billion. That's 2.5 billion between now and 2050. What if 2 billion of those 2.5 billion have a mother who can't read to them? So it seems to me that we are really overlooking this key issue. As you look at the populations growing, if you go off and get education right, then these societies are going to have much, much, much better opportunities. So in 2000, I looked at the problem, the scale of the problem, and realized that it was not going to be scalable to use the old model. You know, the old model was that, you know, a white guy would get rich, and then he'd get old, and he'd start to deploy his money. And it seemed like a very, very, you know, old way of looking at it. My thought was that the Carnegieization of the developing world, to bring books and libraries to kids around the developing world, would require a global network. I would have to use my salesmanship skills, my networking skills, my speaking skills, to go out and build a global network of people who cared about this issue as much as I cared. And there were really four key groups of people that I wanted to go out and recruit to join. And eventually the story goes from I to we as I recruited a team. Along with my co-founder, Aaron, who had worked in Vietnam for Unilever, we went out and said, first of all, we got to have strong local teams. We need to have strong Vietnamese in Vietnam, strong South Africans in South Africa, strong Nepalis in Nepal. The model of sending American expatriates overseas to boss the local people around has never really been that successful. The idea is that you empower local people to solve local problems using their own language. And the local nationals, they're close to the customer. They know how to get things done. The second key group is the group that they engage with, the local communities. It is really critical that we don't simply give something away to a village and then hope that they respect it and hope that they take care of it. Right? The old adage is, Michael Porter, nobody ever has washed their rental car before returning it. Because if you don't feel ownership, you don't take care of it. Our version of ownership is called the Challenge Grant. The idea is very simple. We require communities to donate land. We require communities to donate sweat equity. Many times communities donate small amounts of money, micro contributions, if you will. I've been at schools where up to 3,000 families have each given the equivalent of a dollar in local currency to help their library get built or to help their school get built. The whole adage or the whole idea behind it is you can't help people if they don't want to help themselves. But the good news is throughout the developing world, the work ethic is strong because parents understand that the only way their kids are going to escape poverty and have a better life is through education. So the local teams that we have recruited then work with the local communities, work with the Ministry of Education. So the Ministry of Education agrees to do its job, which is to make sure that teachers show up when you open a school, that you have librarians when you open a library, so the MOE gets looped in. So we've got this model, but then we need to have capital, because without money, you don't have a mission. No money, no mission. You got to be very clear that you're out raising money all the time, 724, 365, and not be shy about it. The idea that we came up with, and we came up with this long before the Obama administration did, we're quite proud of it, is to basically crowdsource capital. Starting in 2000, we started opening fundraising chapters. And we said, our version of volunteering is not going overseas and pick up a hammer and pounding nails, because the local people are willing to go pound those nails, and they should be willing to pound those nails because it's their school. Our version of volunteering is fundraising. Get a group of friends together, raise enough money, build a library, build a school, go visit it, take a vacation in Nepal, whatever you want to do. And this really caught on absolutely like wildfire. I'm absolutely amazed at where it is today. We now have fundraising chapters in 41 cities around the world, including here in San Francisco. We have more than 3,000 people involved in this network. They have collectively raised over $20 million in the last 4 years alone as volunteers without 1 cent on our payroll. Now, $20 million is a lot of money here in San Francisco. It's a heck of a lot of money when you get to a place like Nepal or Cambodia or Vietnam where money goes 100 times as far. So these chapters have been basically self-motivated, self-organized. They're in Amsterdam, they're in Atlanta, they're in Boston, they are in Chicago, they are in Calgary, they are in Dallas, they are in Hong Kong, they're in Osaka, they're in Tokyo, they're in Zurich. What we do is tell people, don't worry about asking your friends for money. Just convene your friends, and John will ask them for money. That appears to have become the model. And we basically say, here's your opportunity. You can fund a long-term scholarship for a girl, you can fund a school, you can fund a library. And thankfully, people respond. The experts, quote-unquote, told us that the Japanese would not raise their paddles in public, that was not the Japanese way. And I'm proud to say that in February, Pushkar, our country director from Nepal, and I were there, and we watched 10 schools get funded in less than 1 minute. That felt really good. Domo arigato, Ogawa-san, for leading the charge on that one. So the chapters then started raising more capital, which allowed us to do the things we needed to do, which was scale, scale, scale. More schools, more scholarships for girls, more libraries, more books. The books were a huge vacuum, because throughout the developing world, one of the problems is the parents can't afford books, so the publishers don't see a business case to publish books. And this is an age-old problem. Why are 98% of the people in the world who are illiterate in the developing world? Lack of local language books has a big thing to do with it. What would life be like growing up as a kid if you didn't have Dr. Seuss, or if kids didn't have Harry Potter, or if kids didn't have Goodnight Moon? Well, if you want to learn the answer to that question, go somewhere in the developing world where you can't find books in the local languages. We decided in 2003 that we had to start doing this because we'd surveyed our first libraries in Nepal and Vietnam, and 52% of the kids we surveyed, we asked the question, what would make you use the library more? Longer hours, open on the weekends, a friendlier librarian, what would it be? And 52% of the kids said they would use the library more often if there are more books in the Nepali language. And that seems like, well, duh, of course that's what you want, but there's this age-old problem of no books. Thankfully, the Skoll Foundation, God bless them, invested in us. We had some great local investors, Don Valentine from Sequoia, Draper Richards Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation backed us early. And that allowed us to go out and find Nepalese authors and Nepalese artists and Vietnamese authors and Vietnamese artists. And these guys are not translating a Western book. These guys are producing local language content, original stories told. I mean, this is a key thing, right? Who do we allow the storytellers to be? Well, I think local kids want to have their stories told in their own language with something that's culturally relevant. This program started with 10 books in our first year, 2003. It's now grown. By the end of this year, we'll have 420 original titles. That, and don't worry, I'm not going to show you all 420 of them. But you get an idea here. We're now publishing in 18 different languages across the world where kids can now have books in their mother tongue. Kids can also have books in English. They can learn English as a second language. But if you don't start with mother tongue, you're not going to really have much luck in literacy. Aww. You know, in all of our books, I just want to say, all of our books do have happy endings. thank God, huh? We were honored in 2006 when the Academy for Educational Development, or AED, gave us their Breakthrough Innovation in Education Award for this local language publishing program, which we were thrilled about. And then we kind of thought it was ironic that publishing local language books with local authors and local artists in a child's mother tongue was not only considered to be an innovation, it was considered to be a breakthrough innovation, which to me says that something's wrong with the world of development when things that are this simple are missed. There's often, I think, a tendency to move towards stuff that's really complex, that's whizzy, that has all kinds of neat technology attached to it, and there may be a role for that, but there's also, I think, a role for real solutions to real problems that can be delivered right now. So the good news from that is that that combination of local employees, of talented fundraising chapters around the world, along with really talented authors and artists, has allowed us to scale this program to absolutely incredible heights. By the end of this year, we'll have put about 6.5 million books into the hands of kids across the developing world. To put that in perspective, if you stacked those books one on top of the other, that would be 14 times as high as the Burj Dubai, the world's tallest building. So think about the power of one book in the hands of one kid. And thankfully now with this program, we control the printing presses, so we can basically produce lots and lots of books. We survey the kids to find out what appeals to them. We then go out, of course, and we have more books so we can actually establish more libraries. The idea originally of one library in Bahundanda has now grown markedly to the point now where we open one new library every 4 hours and 40 minutes somewhere in the developing world. We open 5 libraries a day right now. The average library reaches 400 kids. So every day, on average, 2,000 kids get access to their first library. So that's what happens, I think, when you take the idea of the business mentality of scale and attach it to the educational ideal of having highly relevant products and services that literally you have thousands of communities lining up who want to take part in this. Now, we looked at this a couple of years ago and said, we're growing very, very quickly. Let's look at us versus a for-profit company, because if the business world knows one thing, the business world knows how to scale. So we decided we'd compare ourselves to Starbucks and look at how quickly they opened outlets post-IPO versus how quickly Room to Read is opening libraries. And they're in yellow and we're in green. And as you see, the first couple of years, they're kicking our butt. By the fourth year, we're pulling ahead. You know, their eighth year post-IPO, they opened 1,000 outlets, which was kind of cute. And we opened 1,600 libraries in our eighth year. So the reason I say this is I'm very, very proud of our teams, because that model of the fundraising chapters around the world putting the nitrous oxide in the tank that allows our local teams to say yes, 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 not no or not yet to these communities, we've been able to grow our program substantially. Our girls' scholarship program now, by the end of this year, we'll have about 9,000 girls on long-term scholarships. We've sponsored over 25,000 girl years of education over the course of the last 9 years. 25,000 girl years literally is about 700,000 days a little girl could walk into school and be supported by Room to Read. I'm proud to say that Ich bin ein Feminist. If we don't get this issue right, we will never get any other issue right, because half the planet is female and half the students in the world should be female. We give the girls everything they need to be successful. We give them mentoring. We give them after-school tutoring. We give them these ridiculously oversized Room to Read backpacks. I commented a few years ago that I thought we should, it's great to be ambitious and all, but we might want to downsize the backpacks a little bit before we kill these children. And then about 6 months ago, I was going through some recent photos from Nepal, and just to prove that nobody really listens to me, this is the latest incantation. The backpacks appear to have been supersized. Last year, 98% of our girls passed to the next grade. These girls come from absolutely destitute conditions, but with mentoring, with tutoring, with strong local women who are on our payroll looking after the girls, they want to succeed and they will succeed. Girls like Debbie Taru, who 2 years ago was a household slave. She was an indentured servant. She's a Kamwari girl, a caste that is traditionally sold into indentured servitude. A wonderful group that's based out of South Salido, Nepalese Youth Opportunity Foundation, many of you may know, Olga Murray is a saint, and Soam Panero, their country director in Nepal, is also a saint. They free these girls from bonded labor. 700 girls have been freed under a partnership where NYOF frees them, Room to Read puts them on scholarship, and they go quickly from what they are living in to having these absolute 10-megawatt smiles that could power a small village. So the partnership angle is very important, as we're always looking for partnerships we can do so that we can do more together. And then finally, we launched a program this year in Bangladesh, and then finally, we've opened 850 schools across the developing world using this community labor model, the challenge grant model. By next year, that number should be about 1,300 schools will have opened somewhere around the developing world. We're opening right now a new school every 34 hours using the model of fundraising in the wealthy parts of the world, deploying using the parental labor. It's a huge number. And you know what it means for me, really, to put it in context, is that every day, you know, over 200,000 little people can wake up and have a place to go. You know, these kids are in a tsunami-impacted village in Sri Lanka. They've known civil war. They've known a tsunami. Yet, you know, they go to school with these big smiles on their faces and these ridiculous 1980s new wave ties. I don't know where they got those, but anyway. So in closing, you know, people ask me all the time, you know, how has my life changed? And, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, doing this, what are the lessons? And I would say just briefly, you know, I work longer hours now than I ever worked at Microsoft, which is saying a lot. The whole notion that charity should be something that people dabble in 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, I think, is a canard. And, you know, people say that businesses need to be run efficiently, but damn, I mean, charities have got to be run, NGOs have got to be run efficiently, because if we don't reach these kids, something else will, because nature abhors a vacuum. And, you know, look no further than Afghanistan if you want to have proof of the fact that if we don't get this right, the repercussions will be with us for generation after generation after generation. I make less money than I've ever made before in my life. I'm no longer motivated by money or motivated by status, but it's, you know, it's something to think about. I'm still renting. I thought that by this point in my life, I would probably own something, but I don't. So there's definitely, you know, risk factors of doing, you know, quitting your day job and pursuing this. I would say that the most positive change for me has been a really, really simple one. My coach Jeff Balin is a wonderful guy, and he's a good Buddhist. He's like a Buddhist MBA, which is a rare combination. But Jeff's theory basically is, he said, the secret to life is to figure out what you want to say in your deathbed, and then work backwards from there. And I feel like when I worked at Microsoft, I never really knew, you know, what I would want to say on my deathbed. When that headmaster asked me to go see this school and we had to cross these bridges, it was kind of a metaphorical bridge. On this side was, you know, terra firma, the known world, Microsoft and a large paycheck. And then the other side was this absolutely, like, terra incognita, with a very, very scary journey in between. But what I ended up getting out of that was that notion that like every day of my life was going to certainly be interesting and hopefully full of some significant victories, like this day in rural Laos that a new school opened and the entire village followed us for a mile and a half down to the place where our boat was moored to go down the river. And every day for me now, it's just filled with goodness because there's challenges to it, certainly. I travel more than I've ever traveled in my life, but you get these shots of these kids and you see kids reading books. You see, I was in Nepal last week and I visited six of our schools and you just see this energy. In India, we got a report that one of the girls is taking books home and teaching her illiterate mother to read. And our India staff took this photo and the mother was so proud, she pulled out a pencil and she's starting with her name. Right now, all she can write is her name. But her daughter is teaching her. And you think about that and you say, there's a lot of bad stuff happening in the world, but damn, there is a lot of good stuff. There are boys that I'll always remember, like Tan, a 15-year-old boy in Vietnam. At the opening of his library in the summer of 2007, he came up to me and he stuck his hand out and he gave me like an insurance salesman's handshake, looked me right in the eye, and he said, "Mr. John Wood, I wish to thank you for our library. My goal is to read every book in the library. First, every book in Vietnamese, then every book in English. What do you think of my goal, Mr. John Wood?" And you know, and I said, "Well, Tan, there's 1,000 books in the library." I mean, that's like kind of like Debbie Downer. I'm like, "There's 1,000 books. Are you sure you can do it?" And he said, "It is no problem." He said, I came in. He like actually had broken into the library the night before it opened, and he had a flashlight, and he said, "I read 9 books last night." And it's for kids like him, you know, that we all work so hard. You know, in Cambodia, when I go there now, I no longer obsess about the killing fields and the Khmer Rouge. And it reminds me again of there's a proverb that is the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is today. And what I know is my team is planting a lot of trees. In Sri Lanka now we have girls who are coming to us with their ideas. They've read books, and now they're saying they want to write books. They want to illustrate books, like Baby Fish Goes to School, which also, like The Lost Baby Elephant, also has a very, very happy ending. Kids we see who so understand the importance of reading that they are inculcating the habit in their stuffed animals every day in the library. But we know that there's a lot of work left to be done. There are, you know, still literally hundreds of millions of people who are illiterate, hundreds of millions of kids who are not in school. This photo was borrowed from the New York Times last month in South Africa. Kids were marching in the streets demanding better schools, demanding. And look at that sign on the upper right-hand corner. We need functioning libraries in our schools. Kids are demanding this. They ask, we deliver. That is our goal, is to deliver these services to as many kids as possible. The last words of my presentation will not be mine. They will be the words of this young boy. I got this email on Saturday from my co-founder and our CEO, Erin Ganju. She had been in South Africa with a group of our investors and wrote to our staff about this young boy who presented at one of our Run Read libraries. His name, if you can read it on his little sweater, his name literally is Mr. Poet. And he wrote a poem. The poem is called Miss Library. Miss Library, you're the quiet lady full of respect and dignity. You attend to people who take time to seek information. Your shelves are full of books filled with knowledge and inspiration. Through you, I share ideas of important people like William Shakespeare and Desmond Tutu. The dinosaurs became extinct before our time, but you kept record and make them come alive for us. Anytime I visit you seeking knowledge, I depart more powerful. Knowledge is power. When I seek a good story, you leave me inspired. Oh, Miss Library, you are one of a kind. You are the mother of all nations. You feed the nations with knowledge and wisdom. Feed us. Mr. Poet is one of 5 million kids who will have access to our libraries by the end of 2010. Our goal is not to stop there. It's to go to at least 10 million kids we're serving by 2015. And just keep growing and growing and growing from there. So thank you, everybody, for your time and for your attention, and I'll just leave you with one closing thought. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, John. That was fantastic. In fact, that was so engaging that our audience members haven't had time to write their questions yet. So if you would
excellent, let's call it a night and get a drink.
So I'm going to start off with the first question while they take the time to write out their questions. So what's next for you, and are there certain areas, room to read, wants to go into that you have not yet?
Yeah, like everywhere that we're needed. I mean, it's a very, very long list. I mean, we've opened 9 countries in 9 years, so we've not been shy about going off and expanding our work. I didn't really mention the countries, but you probably picked them up from the presentation. South Africa and Zambia were our first 2 African countries, and our goal is to expand up to the north and to the northeast through Malawi, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, possibly Kenya. I would like to bring Rimnareed into Central America. There's a number of places there where we're needed. I know that you obviously are going to, you know, kind of grill me here on Pakistan, but certainly at some point I think there's a very, very big need in Pakistan, and I could picture Rimnareed working there one day. But really, I mean, the answer really is everywhere that we're needed. Our model is such that we can make a little bit of money go a long way. And so that's one of our gating factors, though, is that if you look at the cost per child served, not to get too clinical about it, but we do want to work in places where we can make a dollar go a long way, because we don't have an endowment. We don't have any sugar daddies or sugar mamas. We're taking applications if you're willing to be a sugar daddy or a sugar mama. But we have to raise every dollar that we deploy. So we do have to look at, you know, where can you go in and literally, you know, have the intervention of a girl's scholarship is $250 per girl per year. The intervention of a library in Asia is about $4,000 to serve 400 kids. So it's $10 per child served to give a kid opportunity. So that's a key part of our model. But I would hope that Rimnareed will just simply keep growing and growing and growing, because we're literally turning away thousands of villages, and we have at least a dozen countries asking us to come in, which kills me. Like, how do you say no to that? How do you look a parent in the eye and say, sorry? How do you look a 5-year-old in the eye and go, meh? Sorry, hold on for 10 years. It's too late by then.
Okay, so one of the questions is, what challenges have you encountered in trying to get girls into schools?
I would say probably the biggest challenge is that every time that we announce an expansion of our scholarship program, we have more applications than we can possibly handle, so we're turning kids away. It's more of a funding problem now than anything else. In the beginning, it was really hiring strong local people to work for us and basically training them. And there's a certain, unfortunately, mentality in the international aid world where local workers kind of go from contract to contract to contract. And I'm very annoyed sometimes with this whole 2-year contract cycle where people are convinced that their role is to basically work like 9 consecutive 2-year contracts. And I had dinner with my team in Nepal when I was there last week, and I said, you know, if you just go and hop from lily pad to lily pad to lily pad, 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, what you'll end up accomplishing is really not nearly as substantial as if you take a 10 or 20 year run at something. So I would say the human capital thing can be a challenge for us. We have some absolutely fantastic employees, but you know, when you're working in post-apartheid South Africa or post-Khmer Rouge Cambodia, there are definitely issues with finding local employees who understand Western notions of transparency, accountability, and having a very results-driven culture. It's a problem everywhere in the world. I shouldn't single any place out, but that can be an issue. But of course, if you don't solve education, then that problem is just going to be inherited by, you know, the NGOs that are around in 50 or 100 years. That was a long answer to a short question, wasn't it?
That was great. How are your schools funded, built and operated, and who hires the teachers and maintains the buildings?
Let me answer it in reverse order. The maintenance is done by the local community. We go back and we survey to make sure that the school is being used for its intended purpose, which I'm proud to say that 100% of our schools are still being used as schools. That sounds minor, but it's actually not. You're always worried that they're going to be used to house chickens and goats and fall into disrepair. The teachers are recruited, trained, and funded by the Ministry of Education, either the national or provincial level. That is a key part of our challenge grant model, is the MOE has to step up to do its job. And then the funding comes from Goldman Sachs has done a bunch of schools, Credit Suisse has done a lot of schools, Accenture, volunteer chapters. I don't know if Jadine and Denise are here, I think from our San Francisco chapter. If you guys could just stand up for a moment. These guys have raised a lot of money here in the Bay Area for us and deserve a round of applause. And they want you to be involved. What's that?
The chapter.
What we try to do is basically have a model where there's a causal effect of if you give X, we do Y. So you want to do a library, here's what it costs. You want to do a school, here's what it costs. You want to go visit it, you can go visit it. You want pictures of it, you can get pictures of it. So we're accountable. So it's a very important part of our models. I don't know about the rest of you, but I can give you, sometimes get a little bit annoyed when you give money to an organization and then like a year later you have no idea where your money went. What we do basically is to say it is completely transparent. So if somebody wants to do a raise the roof party and fund a school, they can do it. And we kind of did the Kiva thing starting back in 2000, actually. But we were not really aggregating small amounts of money, 25 or 50 bucks. What we were trying to do is get people to fund an entire school or an entire library or an entire 10-year girls scholarship.
And then how do you ensure that the libraries don't become storerooms again? What type of oversight?
I mean, two words, monitoring, evaluation. Just investing in that area. You know, our goal is to go back to the libraries every 3 months and collect data on how many hours a week is the library open, is a librarian showing up, has a librarian been trained, has a librarian received top-up training, is a librarian training other librarians, how many books are being checked out. Very simple measures that actually help you look at kind of the utilization and the activity rates. Last year, 1.4 million books were checked out of our libraries, which is kind of a nice number. Last year, however, we had over 4 million books in our library, so it wasn't enough of a number, right? The books are being read during the library period, but you have to convince the librarians to overcome that scarcity mentality and say, let the kids take the books home. It's okay if that happens. It's okay if the books get damaged. And it's not easy because most of the adults in these countries didn't grow up with a library. So, I mean, thinking that you're going to plop it all down and it's all going to work beautifully from day one is just not going to happen. You have to go back. And so it's basically monitoring, evaluation, and a lot of training. Last year, we trained 6,400 local people in basic library science in a two-day course taught in the local language by local people with locally developed content. So it wasn't Westerners telling them how to do it. It was Cambodians training Cambodians. And so far, I'd say we're doing pretty well. Do we have challenges? Do we have problems? Oh, yeah, there's libraries that are still, you know, there's a shelf full of books that isn't being utilized very well. Now, you can change that over time and turn that potential energy into kinetic. But the majority of our libraries are actually working pretty well. And, you know, there's two ways you can do things. You can do, like, one library and say you're going to be hyper-focused on it and, like, stage manage it and have everything be absolutely perfect. Or you can go out and plant 5,000 seeds, 10,000 seeds, 15,000 seeds and say, you know, even if 80% of them germinate, that's still a lot of trees that can grow to the sky. So the challenge, I think, is to actually allow yourself to dare to fail, because not everything is going to work. You're working in post-Khmer Rouge Cambodia. Oh, my gosh. Like, I mean, Paul Farmer, Partners in Health, working in Rwanda, that guy's job is not easy, and he's the first to admit that he's not perfect. And the idea of funders expecting you to be perfect is just ridiculous, because if this stuff was easy, it would have been done by now. How many tangents did I go on while answering that question?
It was all great information. Next question is, some countries you work in have some of the most corrupt governments in the world. Corruption affects education and future opportunities. How do you combat corruption while fulfilling your mission, since it ultimately affects it so deeply?
You know, I was coming off of Kilimanjaro in 99, and my buddy Dave and I were going out to the Ngornongono crater, and we had a guide service, and we were in the back of the Land Rover, and the cook and the driver were up front, and we were driving out to the crater, and there was a police stop. And the driver rolls down the window, and his name is Innocent, and Innocent says, may I help you? And the police officer asks for some money. And Innocent looks at the police officer, and he says, what? And the police officer repeats his demand, and Innocent said, I don't understand, made the police officer report it for the third time. And Innocent said, oh, I am very sorry. We do not have it in our trekking budget to pay any bribes. And the police officer looked at him and said, maybe you can give us a Coca-Cola or a sandwich. And Innocent said, we do not have any Coca-Cola or sandwiches here in the vehicle. And he said, okay. And threw out the window, and we drove on. So number one, don't pay bribes. Refuse to give in to the idea that you have to pay money to get things done. It is not true. And one of the things we do is we tell our countries, if this happens, we can take that money and go elsewhere, right? If there's rampant corruption in Cambodia, we can take that money and go to Vietnam or Laos or go to Nepal or go to wherever. If we have a corruption in Zambia, guess what? You lose your budget, we're going to go to South Africa with it, right? We don't have to work here. But I think the most important thing is the challenge grant model, because the local people have invested in each country. Well, how does corruption happen? Corruption, I mean, if you haven't read Dead Aid, Dambisa Moyo's book, please read it. How does corruption happen? A government gives $5 billion to Mobutu Sese Seko, and they go, yeah, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we're going to build schools and hospitals. We're just going to park the money in the Swiss bank for a couple of years just for safekeeping. That's how corruption happens. Corruption happens when well-meaning groups go in and drop off 10,000 pounds of surplus grain, and it's just kind of there, and then it's like whoever wants to get to it first with an Uzi can claim credit. What happens when you go into a village and say to the village, you need to co-invest along with us, is very simple. People don't steal from themselves. I have been at school opening ceremonies where I have watched the local people, literally they pull out a sources and uses of funds statement, and they read every source, and that's, she gave 100 rupees, she gave 200 rupees, you gave 500 rupees. If you'd given 1,000 rupees and I said in public ceremony you gave 500, you know. They then say, here's how we spent the money. Here's what we spent on wood, on desks, on glass, on this, on that, on that. And if they go, well, they spent a lot of money on cement, and that headmaster's brother runs the local cement company, that seems kind of fishy. So you basically build it into your model. Will it happen? Oh, yeah, it'll happen. I mean, there's a reason we have Microsoft's former CFO on our board of directors running our audit committee, because you have to audit early and you have to audit often. And if you find corruption, you fire. Simple as that. You send a signal. And we fired employees for corruption. It's going to happen. You just try to basically build your business model around it. You audit early, you audit often, and if you do find it, no excuses, you fire people.
How do you attract and retain qualified teachers, especially in the rural areas?
That is the role of the Ministry of Education. We rely heavily on them. It is a criteria when we look at countries we're going to go into. If there's not a good teacher training program in that country or there's not a sufficient number of teachers, we simply won't build schools in that country. So we're very, I mean, I'll be very clear. We are not a teacher training organization. We are not a curriculum development organization. We are not trying to solve every single part of the educational supply chain. What we are trying to do is pick the areas we feel we can have a big impact and then rely on partnerships and rely on the Ministry of Education. But if the MOE does not do its job on teachers, then there's just no sense in us building schools. I also want Wendy Kopp to do like Teach for Everywhere, because you know the Teach for All thing is going to hopefully go really well, but ideally if you could actually get the next generation of Nepalese and Cambodians and Indians and South Africans to believe that teaching is cool, that would be a big thing. So I'm a huge fan of Wendy and her team and what they're doing, and I hope that they can grow their programs internationally, because that would actually be one other way to help assure teacher quality.
And there's several questions similar to this one. What would be your advice for a small group of young professionals trying to start an organization aimed at helping the developing world? Do you have any advice for formulating a mission statement?
Well, my first piece of advice would be to go and look at the word start and whether or not that word is necessary. Do you need to start an organization, or do you just need to go find something that works and back it and help take it to scale? Because there are 1.2 million NGOs in America alone. There's over 10 million NGOs in India. Most of them, the majority of them, have budgets less than $100,000. And unfortunately, you can't really do that much with $100,000. You can do some stuff. But I would argue that what the world needs right now, there are needs for new organizations where there are vacuums. So the first question really is, what are you passionate about? And if what you're passionate about, if there's a huge vacuum, then go start an organization. But if you're passionate about microfinance, just go talk to the guys at Kiva and figure out how can you help them to grow fast. If you're passionate about education in the developing world, talk to our San Francisco chapter, talk to my team, get involved with something that actually works and just is in the middle of scaling, because that also is, and that's actually sometimes can be a much more effective way to do it. Now, I realize, of course, that I have to defend myself here, is I actually started an organization. But the reason I started it was that I went out and tried to figure out who's trying to be the Carnegie of the developing world, and not opening 1 or 10 or 20 libraries, but opening literally, hopefully, tens of thousands, and I couldn't find it. So that's why I decided, maybe it was hubristic, but that's why I started my own organization. But I don't think it's always necessary to start one.
Oh, by the way, I think that's for you.
Oh, cool. My mom called. Awesome. No. God, she's always... No. Where are Kushal and Oliver? Two of our guys are here. Kushal's here from India, and Oliver is here from our South Africa, our African regional headquarters. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Welcome. Give them a San Francisco welcome. They're severely jet-lagged, so they need your energy right now, and... But say hi to them. And it's actually a couple. Who's here from the Room to Read team? Just in case people want to wait. Keep them up. in case people will have questions or want. Okay, great.
All right, the next question is, given President Obama's big push for volunteerism, can you please discuss Room to Read's philosophy on bringing your program into the U.S. and why you may or may not do that?
We won't do that, not because we're not patriotic, but to the point of vacuums, there is just absolutely a lot of great work being done in the United States in the education area. There's some really great groups that I personally support, like Donors Choose. There are groups like Teach for America. Our model really is all about taking a little bit of money and making it go a long way. And if you have $5,000 in Cambodia, you can go work with a village and open a library and support it for year after year after year and reach hundreds of kids. On $5,000 in where we work, where we live in San Francisco, you can't really do much of anything. And there's a government that's spending, I think the state of California is putting about $65 billion a year into education. So there, as a small player, you can't really do that much. I believe in what the Gates Foundation says, is that all lives are equal. So if you believe that a kid is a kid is a kid, I want to go out and serve kids in places where they don't have a lot of advocates. That's not to say that, I mean, if you're a fan of education, it should never be either or. You should invest everywhere as if you have money to give away. But if you're looking at it as an organization, you've got to figure out what your sweet spot is. And our sweet spot really is going to the places where you literally have the poorest of the poor, and a little bit of money goes a long way. It's not a popular answer, but every organization has to have its focus. And if it gets too defocused, it'll just become part of history.
Thank you. How does an organization partner with yours?
There is a very efficient process. There on our website, there is a partnership form that we ask people to fill out, kind of who are you, what do you do, what's your mission, where do you work, and what ideas do you have for working together. It can be emailed to us, and then our team checks it out and tries to make introductions. Most of our partnership decisions are actually made in country. I have a lot of times people come up to me and say, you know, my parents have an orphanage in Cambodia. Can you set up a library there? And I'll say, yeah, it sounds like a great idea, theoretically, but why don't you have your team in Cambodia talk to our team in Cambodia and have them as Cambodians decide how they should do that. But that's all up at roomtoread.org, and we've tried to make a very, very efficient process. And if it takes us a while to get back to you, we apologize, but we're a low overhead organization, so our staff is usually pretty overwhelmed.
And then this is from...
Oh, and we're hiring, by the way.
Well, the next question is, what can we do to help in San Francisco with the San Francisco chapter?
I don't know. Do you guys want to answer that?
Yeah.
A little louder. Stand. So the Beers for Books idea started off in Tokyo, a guy named Gary Bremerman, and the idea basically is he went to bars. This is why I love the fundraising chapters, they're very entrepreneurial. But he went to a bunch of bars and said, I can put 300 people in your bar on a relatively slow night. You just have to give 100 yen per drink to Room to Read. And the Beers for Books idea was kind of cool because our local language publishing program prints books for $1 a piece. So, you know, you have a beer, a kid gets a book. They've now done 25,000 beers and 25,000 books, and it's actually spread all around the world now as one of the simplest fundraising ideas. If don't make it complicated, just invite your friends and get the bar to give you a buck a drink.
And the final question is, what does this do to your personal life?
Oh boy. You know, my business life and my personal life have done absolute hostile takeovers of each other. It's been a very friendly merger, but I used to be a banker, so I talk about mergers. But no, I mean, it's funny. It's my friends have become donors, and our donors have become friends, and our chapter leaders have become friends, and my friends have become chapter leaders, and I travel all over the world. And so it's kind of wherever I wake up is my home for that day. I travel a lot to build Room to Read. I mean, these 41 fundraising chapters didn't just happen. I mean, you had to have somebody out there passionately advocating and speaking to groups like this to say, come on, Atlanta, come on, Chicago, come on, Brussels, let's do something together. So It's been a bit of a challenge for me. I mean, remember like a year ago, I got this wake-up call, and I was in this dark hotel room, and they said, Mr. Wood, this is your wake-up call, and it's 7 a.m., and I said, great, and I said, can you tell me, where am I? And she said, and very charming, she said, Mr. Wood, you're in Sao Paulo. And I said, great, thank you, and I hung up, and I go, why am I in Sao Paulo? And I was like, oh yeah, the Brazilian version of my book. We're doing the Brazilian, and literally, so my life is a little bit, there's a chapter in my book called Your Life is a Mess, and it's all about being pulled over. How many of you speed on Lombard? Not the twisty part, but like the straight part. It's like drag racer. It's like, so I'm speeding down Lombard, and I'm late for a, this is when my office is in a Presidio, and I'm late for a meeting, and you know, sure enough, this cop pulls me over, and he's like straight out of Central Casting. He's got the boots and the helmet and the mirrored sunglasses and the gloves, and he's like, license and registration, please. And so I look through my glove compartment, and I can't find either of those things, and I pull out a registration like this. This expired a year ago. I go, oh, yeah, oh, actually, I think it's in my trunk. I open my trunk, and there's just like this cacophony of unpacked bags and dry cleaning I've not dropped off and newspapers I've not read and a broken computer and running shoes and hiking shoes. And it's just, and I'm looking through my bag and I'm like pull out an insurance thing, and he's like, no, this is expired too. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I just got back from this long trip. And he asked for my license, and I gave him a Washington State license, and he said, when did you move from Washington? And I'm like, a while ago. And he looks at me and he shakes his head and he goes, your life is a mess. But he didn't give me the ticket. I didn't get a ticket. He felt really sorry for me. So,
that was great.
Is my life neat? No. Is my life interesting? My life is really interesting. And the best thing about it is wherever I go in the world, whether it's Nepal or whether it's Tokyo or Osaka, or whether it's Singapore or Hong Kong or Atlanta or Boston or Greenwich, I have so many friends, and most of them have come because of Room to Read. And I'll close just with that statement, is that one thing I've discovered about what I do now versus what I used to do at Microsoft is that people who interact with me because they want to interact with me. In my old life, a lot of people interacted with me because they had to interact with me, whether they wanted to or not. I controlled something. And I think the biggest difference between what I used to do and what I do today is that people make a choice to interact with me. And I think the great thing about Room to Read's growth is that I'm no longer standing alone at the chip dip. I actually have company now because we're successful. So people now see what the craziness was all about. So, and if you haven't checked out the work Sarah's doing, by the way, I just want to put in a quick pitch that Developments in Literacy is doing absolutely amazing work in Pakistan, and she's been a very wonderful moderator by not talking about herself, so thank you for that. But Sarah, to you and your team, congratulations, because certainly everything I've said about education, if we get it right in Pakistan, the future's brighter. If we don't get it right, we're going to see a lot more of the same. So thank you for your work, too.
Thank you. That's so well said. And on behalf of the World Affairs Council's Young Professional International Forum and our co-sponsors, the Indus Entrepreneurs and Books, Inc., please join me in thanking John Wood for his insights and being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And I also would like to thank you.